history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this incredible country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary men and women around you who have done really extraordinary things for the sake of our country. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in Hollister, California, sitting with Mr. Del Byler, who they said was 98 years old, but I don't know if I'm buying it. Is that true? 98 years old?
And a half.
Okay, see, it wasn't true. 98 and a half. And this is going to be some kind of journey we're going to hear today. It spans World War II and the Korean War, and even some history that a lot of people don't know in Vietnam. But I want to go back to Kansas. You're born in Garden City, Kansas, but you grow up pretty much in the middle of nowhere, it sounds like.
Calvista, Kansas. Calvista was our mailbox city. Our dad had a ranch, and I worked on the ranch. Calvista was a town of 12 people. We lived 7 miles from downtown, so we were pretty much out in the middle of nowhere.
I didn't know that a town of 12 people could have a downtown. What's the difference between downtown and uptown?
Well, we had 2 gas stations, a general store, and a couple of residences, that's all.
And later on, when you became a father, I'm sure you regaled your children with stories about what you had to do to get to school in the morning.
Oh, I did. Actually, people they think I was kidding when I said it was 7 miles to school.
7 miles from your house to the school?
But after I was married, we went there and I had a new Buick and I timed it and it was 7 miles if you go by the roads.
But you didn't go by the roads?
No, I wouldn't go by. I'd cut across the prairie or across the alfalfa fields, but mainly across the prairie.
And what was your mode of transportation?
Horseback or walking. In the winter, you don't want to go horseback because it's too darn cold. You get frozen sitting on top of a horse in the winter. So I walked or rode a horse 7 miles. I went to a one-room schoolhouse. We had usually 5 or 6 students in the whole school. It was one room. And I went through the 9th grade there. Then I had to go to high school, and I went to Topeka, Kansas. And my aunt and uncle took me in for the school years.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are a little envious. They wish they had gotten to ride a horse to school. But how young were you when you were riding a horse to school?
Oh, I was riding a horse when I was still on the Dills Ranch, 4 or 5. I was too young. I would get the horse, lead him up to the gate there where you could kind of climb up on the boards. It was Alabama. I still remember that horse's name. He was a very gentle horse. We'd lead him up to the gate, and I'd climb up the gate boards and get a straddle of him. I wouldn't do anything rash, but I could ride my horse.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about your parents. You send a kid off alone on horseback 7 miles away, expecting him to actually make it back with the same horse? That the horse doesn't run off somewhere while he's in school?
Well, we had a big barn. The barn was larger than the school, actually. Yeah.
So you weren't the only one riding your horse to school?
No. No, there are 2 or 3 of us who rode horses to school. But I think I had the farthest distance to school. And the school teacher always stayed with us. Every year, school teacher stayed with us. We had the nicest house.
Well, I bet you got good grades, too, if you had the school teacher staying in your house.
No, that didn't affect it. But it was camaraderie anyway.
Uh-huh. That's a colorful childhood. Do you remember in those days having some ambitions, having some dreams that someday you wanted to do this and that?
Yes. Even when I was a little guy riding a horse or driving a tractor, I always thought that I wanted to do, when I retired, which I didn't know when it would be, I had no idea to be here, that I wanted to be self-sufficient. I didn't want to depend on the children. So I planned a long, long time ago to make enough money so I could retire. And I did.
When did this idea of flying airplanes first cross your mind?
When I was in Chicago, actually, during the terrible dust storms we had in western Kansas, you may have read about them. Those were terrible. People died in those darn things. That was very tough on Dad. I remember we drove cattle all the way from Cal Vista to Dodge City, which is over quite a distance. I dropped out of college. I went to Chicago. I still had a work, ethic. And the owner of Permaflex liked me because I pitched in. And anyway, make a long story short, he had an airplane. He paid for my first lessons and paid for my instruction and all and my flying expenses. And I had my private license, and I was going to like to fly. I was determined to fly.
What was the first airplane you flew?
Probably an Aronca.
Aronca, yeah.
I think.
You mentioned dropping out of college, so you're actually at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, and you hear what's going on with your dad, and you thought you needed to make some money?
Yes, I didn't want to take any more money from Dad for college.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried, I was a pre-med at that time. I was trying to work and pay my expenses, and I didn't like it very well. So I dropped out of college and went to Chicago and worked there for a while, and that's where I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you were on December 7th, 1941, huh?
Exactly. Yes, what sir. It was devastating to me. I had a good friend that worked at Permaflex where I worked. He and I together went, I don't know, 7 or 7:30, December 8th, to downtown Chicago to enlist in the aviation program. That was the Air Corps at that time, and that was the morning after Pearl Harbor, and we were downtown at least by 8 o'clock at the time the place
opened. Why was that so important to you? Why were you in such a hurry?
Well, I've always felt kind of patriotic. I had a couple of years of college, and I was in good physical shape. I didn't know it, but I was colorblind. I found out that I was colorblind. I missed some of the color charts, mm-hmm. and the examiners said, oh, well, he's in good physical shape, and he's qualified for everything else. I was actually sworn into the Army Air Corps. Then I quit my job and went home to the ranch. I didn't get any, I was supposed to get orders. I didn't get any orders for a while, so I wrote to the Air Corps and said, here I am, maybe you forgot. I wish I'd kept that letter. That was a classic letter I got, personally signed by the head of the Air Corps, thanking me for my patriotism, but I was colorblind. Report to your draft board. That was a disaster. I didn't want to report the draft board. I wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. I had to report the draft board to register, but I didn't want to do it.
So you found another way.
Yes, it was kind of laborious. I heard that carrots were good for your eyes, so I ate a lot of carrots. I learned to read the color charts.
You cheated.
I did cheat. I cheated, but I made it. I was successful.
Not that we want to prescribe this for anyone else who might have these ideas, but how'd you cheat? How'd you pull that off? How'd you beat the test?
Well, I learned that, first of all, I tried to build up my eyes. I don't know how much good that did. I really don't. But I learned that by squinting and kind of following the characters there, I could read them. I gave myself one day to enlist. I told them that I had flunked out of the Army aviation program because I was colorblind. But hell, I could read the charts. So they said, you're in.
So you proved it to them.
And then I was 5 pounds underweight.
So you're still not home free. So you find a way to cheat the test, but they still won't take you because you're too skinny.
Yeah, another disaster. I was 5 pounds underweight. I had been living pretty well at that point. I was making lots of money, and I was living too well. But anyway, I was under their minimums. So I went out in Chicago to a restaurant and ate a huge breakfast, and I'd heard the bananas were good, were weighty, so I ate all the bananas I could think of, and I took a big drink of water before I got on the scale, and I gained 5.5 pounds in an hour.
Wow.
And they said, fine, sign here.
So you're in. You finally have your goal of being in an aviation program, but getting from there to fighter pilot is a long journey. Were there some other hurdles you had to clear?
Well, there were hurdles. I was in the first class to go all the way through from flight prep at Liberty, Missouri. And then I graduated eventually from Corpus Christi. I was serious about my flying. I enjoyed it. And I was doing okay on the flying part.
What did it feel like for you to be in the cockpit? What was the thrill that you got out of it?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody has ever asked me that before, but there's a feeling of, I'm kind of a bug about control. I had control of independence, and I loved to fly. It just was a great pleasure.
But isn't it a little nuts to fly off a carrier and then have to land on it, especially at night?
Well, I had to build up to that a little bit. I graduated from Corpus Christi, got my wings at Corpus Christi. Then I went to Melbourne, Florida. The powers that be said, we need night fighters. Who will volunteer to be a night fighter? Hell, we didn't want to volunteer. We're going to fight the war. I think only one guy volunteered for night fighting. That wasn't enough. They took the top percent of the class and said, you're now night fighters. So I became a night fighter.
So when you say we didn't want to be night fighters, we wanted to go fight the war, you mean you knew that night fighters meant you'd have to go through more training.
Oh, yes, exactly.
And you wanted to go over there right now and
I
fight
was
the
ready.
Japanese.
Yeah. I was a hot pilot, I thought. Maybe I wasn't, but I thought so.
And at the time, you're flying Hellcats, F-6Fs?
F-6F. Uh-huh. Then I started flying the F-6F-5N. That's the night fighter version of the Hellcat.
So how did you feel about that? I mean, here you're saying you're hot to go overseas and get some action, but they're keeping you here to learn night fighting.
Paul, I'm not sure what service you've had, but when you're in the service, the thing to do, you do it because you're there. What the hell? I mean, that's the only reason you do it. Mm-hmm. And there's no excuse.
So don't waste your time worrying about it, huh?
No time to worry about it.
All right. Well, how big of a challenge was that to learn how to do all of this in the dark?
It was a big challenge. Flying nights. Well, we went to Vero Beach and flew for a while after Melbourne. We had the top equipment of any of the Navy. Actually, I shouldn't tell you this, but we used to flat out over the Everglades. And we had friends at the Everglades Club. And we would sometimes come over Lake Worth at minimum altitude and because we had the equipment for it, and buzzed Lake Worth, and a few things like this. A few things I shouldn't have done.
Buzzed a few people down there? Buzzed a few crocodiles? Alligators?
Everything down there, Paul.
Uh-huh. Well, and explain to folks who might not understand, what's the difference there? What was so special about these new altimeters you had?
Well, they were accurate. They let you fly. Actually, I flew under telephone wires one time there. As soon as I could.
That's pretty low.
It's just the best equipment, is all, Paul.
And it used a radio frequency to give you an accurate altitude reading?
It was actually radio waves would bounce off the land or the water. And we trained it over the ocean a lot. Depending on whether it's the sky was dark or whether it was light, if it was dark, we would try to get to approach the bogey above them, maybe 150 feet or something. And if the sky was light, we'd try to silhouette the bogey above the sky, and we'd fly pretty low. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, but it was kind of fun.
Well, the implication is that the margin for error is a lot smaller, right? I mean, when you're flying in those conditions, when you're flying at that low altitude and in the dark.
Well, there are other margins for errors that are smaller later on, but yes, that's true.
Well, you're teasing us, huh? You're letting us know that we have something to look forward to that's even more hair-raising. Have you ever thought about what would have happened to you if they didn't divert you to the night fighting squadron? If you had been able to go overseas right then?
Yeah, I would have gone overseas and probably been. My training was carrier-based. Mm-hmm. I flew all of my flying was off of straight deck carriers. And do you know the difference between a straight deck and a canted deck carrier? Mm-hmm. Straight deck carriers are fine for props, but they're too darn small for jets.
Right.
But my squadron in Korea was, all of us were flying jets off of straight deck carriers. That was the Essex, the old Essex. I would have been aboard the carriers.
Well, I just bring it up because I'm sure you're confident. I'm sure you believe you would have made it through there. But there are a lot of fighter pilots who got shot down over there.
Yeah. Well, I am fortunate. I came through whole.
His six children are certainly thankful for that. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come from 98-year-old Del Byler of Hollister, California, a Navy fighter pilot who flew both propeller-driven and jet aircraft off of carriers even at night, and even in very sensitive times when America was not supposed to be involved. We're going to hear about that before we're done. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Dell then and now, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.